on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And coming up today, catch limits for scallop fishers released as the 11-armed sea star wreaks havoc.
Whether it's currents or warmer waters, some aspect of settlement of the sea stars that's occurred that's caused this. We're not sure of the mechanism yet. They're definitely out there and there's definitely a lot of them, and they're definitely impacting the scallop beds.
And a Hereford cattle making a comeback to more farms in the state.
I would say, especially this year up at the Wiener sales, the Herefords have, the well-bred ones have been right up there and probably as good or better than the top Angus.
Yeah, we'll take you to a Central Highlands farm where they specialise in Hereford cattle and also a unique breed of sheep on the property as well. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Thursday where we preview the latest commercial scallop season. But it's almost like a horror movie for the scallop fishers due to a lack of numbers in waters off the coast, and fishers say they're not happy with the way things are being managed. Also coming up today, why aren't we eating more rabbits? Once a staple on Australian tables, rabbit meat is not a cheap alternative anymore. When was the last time you cooked rabbit at home, and why have people stopped eating the wild rabbits? We'll look at that issue today. A check on the weather in around 10 minutes from now, a bit of rain about, and we had a half a mil up until midday here at the Hobart studios. You too can be part of the Country Hour with your thoughts via that text line. 0438 922 936 is the number. Well, just days out from the official opening of the commercial scallop season, Tasmanian fishers are feeling frustrated with how it's being managed. Typically, the designated areas to fish across the entire season would be made available by now. So far, boats will be permitted to fish between St Helens Point and Wineglass Bay, but there's a catch cap of 500 tonnes. Fisherman Stuart Ritchie says it's a backward approach to managing the fishery.
The official PAC is 2,500 tonnes, which is a lot of scallops. It's fine. But then there's a catch cap of 500 tonnes, so I'm not exactly certain what that means. The only area that's opened on the east coast has got a catch cap of 500 tonnes, so that's basically what the TAC is. So I'm not sure why that's the case. Catch caps, all they do is foster a race to fish, and that's the last thing we want. We want an orderly fishing campaign so that fish are landed in the best condition, but if you put a catch cap on, it's almost like an Olympic total allowable catch where you go for your life to get your share of that 500 tonnes before it's gone.
Is this the first time something like this has happened, like a catch cap so small within such a large range for a TAC?
Yeah, certainly in my memory that, you know, we've moved on light years from all this sort of management. Yeah, this has just taken us backwards. Commonwealth was where the starfish infestation started, and we knew what was happening there. The amount that the Commonwealth through AFMA have given it, industry asked for 40 tonnes in each area so we could look while boats were going transiting Bass Strait. No, we deal with that. Here we have a lot more live scallops, and really it's a case of trying to salvage what we can of them before the starfish clean them up. And one area in particular that we wanted opened up off Flinders Island, which we were prepared to close an area of smaller scallops inshore, close 3,500 tonnes of small scallops inshore, which in my mind is stupidity anyway because the starfish are going to eat them, but anyway, so be it. But there was an area, or there is an area, of beautiful large scallops that some of the survey scallops that have been landed this year have come from there. And they have a lot of starfish in there. We want to get in there as quickly as we can to try and salvage what we can. But it's almost like starfish are taking preference over human consumption at the moment, which I can't understand, particularly seeing some of the starfish are an invasive species. They're not even a native animal.
But the 11-armed is a native species. This is the problem for the industry, isn't it?
The 11-arm is a native species. Tasmania also has the Pacific sea stars, which have greatly increased in range, and we've been reporting to NRE for the last 8 or 10 months that they've increased their range, that Marion Bay near Tryobunna is absolutely full of them. But now we're finding a lot of them up between Eddiston Point and Flinders Island, which is really concerning because that's hundreds of miles away from where they first started.
Do they work in a similar fashion to the 11-armed through beds? Once they've cleaned out something, they keep moving. If there's no food, they keep moving.
Yep, that's it, exactly. They operate exactly the same as the 11-arms, and they just go through a bed like a plague of locusts, quite frankly.
I know there's only about half a dozen boats. Is there some way that you can work together to ensure everyone's got a fair catch?
Oh, the boats always work together, but their catch is determined by their processor as to how much they can handle. And what a race to fish does is mean people will actually land more than their processor wants. And then it creates a glut. Then it creates issues with quality. It's just a stupid backward step that I thought we'd moved on from 20 years ago.
What are you proposing the industry does, or the peak body does, or is it too late because the season's opening on the weekend?
Too late. Damage has been done. The peak body of the Seafood Industry Tasmania and the Scholar Fishermen's Association Tasmania both put in a submission to NRE, totally against the idea of a catch cap for all those reasons I've just talked about. But every single thing that the industry had asked for, which included opening these ones off Flinders Island before the starfish had finished cleaning them up, have all been totally rejected. Every single thing.
Where does it leave processors and the fishermen financially then, if you've got this scenario?
It's a carry-on from last year where there was an area in northeast Tasmania we wanted to open that had reasonably good quantities of good quality scallops, but were being attacked by starfish. And again, we weren't allowed to fish those. We went back this year when we did the surveys in there, and of course, starfish have cleaned them out. So we appear to be being ignored, quite frankly, and there's years and years of industry experience. We're not the managers of the fishery, but there's a lot of experience that we can put into it. But we've got to find somebody who wants to listen to us first. We've had starfish infestations before, and we worked through it. But we'd like to think that department were working with us rather than working against us. And at the moment, I can't really see that.
That's commercial scallop fisherman Stuart Ritchie talking there to Larissa Smith. The fishery is hopeful other areas will be opened up soon. A spokesperson from the Department of Natural Resources and Environment says the 500-tonne catch cap reflects the biomass that's been identified as being available for harvest based on protection of spawning stock in the region. The fishery arrangements for this season follow consideration of relevant information, including scientific advice and information put forward by the industry itself. Well, the scallop story isn't looking much better in Commonwealth waters. That fishery is virtually closed to commercial operations this season, again because of the damage caused by the 11-armed Sea Star. Larissa Smith spoke to Ian Nucky from Fishwell, who's been involved in surveys to determine the extent of the numbers.
So each year we run a survey of key beds in Bass Strait, and we look at the proportion of scallops or the density of scallops in those beds. They're called random stratified surveys, which enable you to extrapolate the information to work out the total tonnage that may be on different beds around Bass Strait. So we only focus on certain areas, and we work out the biomass or the weight of scallops in those areas. And we've been doing that for about a decade. So we've been watching the dynamics of these scallop beds over this time and how they ebb and flow. And last year, we saw a significant increase in the 11-armed Sea Star, and to the point where the fishers started to question whether it was worth fishing some of those beds, and the fishery for the first time took a bit of a back foot, and a lot of the fishermen didn't fish their typical beds because of the amount of dead scallops and the amount of 11-armed Sea Stars that were on those beds.
Can you pinpoint for our audience whereabouts in Bass Strait that these surveys are taking place between Tasmania and Victoria?
So we run surveys sort of south of Apollo Bay off Victoria and to the east of King Island. There's quite a few beds there in Commonwealth waters, and they're also in various positions around Flinders Island as well, so sort of east and west of Bass Strait. So we run surveys there. And so it gives a good outline of what's going on, the fishery as a whole. We don't survey in Tasmanian waters, only Commonwealth waters off three nautical miles off Tassie and Vic.
So you've recently been doing not only these kind of surveys, but just taking a bit of a closer look at the densities of these 11-arm sea stars. What have you noticed on your last few trips?
In 2025, we noticed a significant increase in 11-arm sea stars. In some of the beds, that has increased dramatically this year. So we've just been out very recently, only in the last few weeks, to look at that. And some of the beds that we've been monitoring for many, many years, we've seen the number of live scallops reduced to less than a few percent when they used to be up to, you know, over 75% of the scallop biomass. So we're seeing a lot of old dead and new dead scallop shells, and we've seen the sea star numbers, you know, go up 40-fold in terms of how many sea stars are out there. So it would appear that the sea stars are feeding on the scallops and scallop beds, and there is, you know, some relationship there between the scallop densities and numbers and biomass and the increase in sea stars.
Are you seeing sea stars attacking juvenile beds as well?
We see sea stars on beds that contain both juveniles and adult scallops. We are seeing some recruitment on some beds, which looks like new scallops are coming through. Whether they last through to become a commercial size, we'll wait and see. But there is no doubt that there's a lot of interaction between the two at the moment. And to point out that this is a native species. The 11-arm sea star is native. It's not an introduced species. But we're seeing a big pulse in the numbers, particularly on, you know, some of these beds where there are a lot of scallops.
I know there's been an indication from Tasmanian fishermen that they won't be fishing those waters because of the low numbers. What does it mean for others in Victoria, fishermen in Victoria, who would also be sharing Bass Strait?
The Commonwealth Fisheries operate with a harvest strategy where you have a minimum amount of quota available. I think it's about 150 tonne or so, to conduct surveys and look at what's out there. So we have to demonstrate that there's a lot of scallops out there before a big fishery gets underway, and that occurs each year. And that's why the surveys are undertaken. This year, we saw such concern about the impact of the sea stars on the scallop beds that they decided not to go ahead with the surveys. So we've just used a bit of funding from FRDC, the Fisheries Research and Development Corporation, to look at some of the beds that were impacted by sea stars this year. But in terms of the impact on the allowable catch, you know, usually it's, you know, many thousand, 3,000 or 4,000 tonnes, which is quite a small proportion of what we see out there, which, you know, can be 50, 60, 70,000 tonnes in any one year. But this year they've decided that because of the impact on the beds that they'll, you know, the TAC won't go over 150 tonnes, which is only used to really undertake the survey. So a huge impact on fishers in Commonwealth waters for sure.
So it's basically shut for this season?
Commercially, yes. It's effectively shut this season. And we'll wait and see what happens. We'll wait and see whether the recruits come through or not. But it's certainly, you know, not a good time to be depending on scallops for an income in Commonwealth or would appear Tassie waters as well.
You've been a fishery scientist for many decades now, and you would have seen these sea star populations rise and fall in that time. Do you think this is just part of the cycle, or it was just a sort of a freak event that has led to their numbers exploding?
Yeah, to be honest, like, we've been running the survey now for over a decade, and we've seen nothing like the numbers we've seen now. There will be cycles. There is in sort of biological ecosystems. There's always cycles. Whether something has led to this, whether it's, you know, currents or warmer waters or some aspect of settlement of the sea stars that's occurred that's caused this, we're not sure of the mechanism yet, but they're definitely out there, and there's definitely a lot of them, and they're definitely impacting the scallop beds.
Yeah, Ian Nucky, director of consultancy firm Fishwell, talking there to Larissa Smith about the scallop surveys in Bass Strait and the damage caused by the 11-armed sea star. Time now on the Country Hour to check the latest on the weather. Ursula Connor joins us from the Bureau. Hello, Ursula.
G'day, Tony.
fair bit of rain about, especially in the north?
Yeah, look, we've got this sort of northerly flow just pushing over the state at the moment, expecting a bit of a rain band to cross through this afternoon. But ahead of that, we have seen just some more lighter showers, really, but fairly persistent pushing into the northern parts of the state. So far today, our highest accumulations have been pushing into sort of the western tiers and up onto the central plateau there, Fisher River and Iris River, both picking up 9 millimetres. Places like Deloraine and Sheffield around 4 millimetres, but elsewhere across the north there, only a millimetre or two in the gauges so far today, Tony.
Yeah, we've got half a millimetre of rain in the gauge at the ABC Hobart studios up until midday, so not too much in the south.
No, that's right. Just a few light showers that passed over sort of the south early this morning. But look, as we move into the rest of the day today, we are going to see this rain band move across the whole state. So we will see those showers extend statewide through the afternoon. It'll probably tend to some pretty moderate rain through the afternoon and evening period about those sort of northern and western parts of the state, Tony. So still a bit more to come today.
Okay, now what sort of temperatures have we got at the moment?
At the moment around the state, we started the day quite warm actually, so the temperatures haven't had far to go. We saw some pretty warm overnight minimums, most places around sort of 11, 12 degrees. Hobart only got down to 12 degrees and Launceston 11. So far today, we've just seen it warming up to around 15 in Hobart and Launceston, also 15 in Devonport, when you're just creeping up towards 16 degrees at the moment. Also 16 in Strawn and 15 in St Helens, Tony.
Okay, let's look at the expectations for Friday, Saturday, Sunday and into Monday.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we'll see this rain band sort of clearing off the east coast early tomorrow morning. And then we'll see another cold front move across the state sort of through tomorrow afternoon and evening. So that's going to bring another burst of showers across the state. But a bit more of a traditional cold front, Tony. We'll see that nice, cool southwesterly change come through behind it. So we do see an end to these sort of very unseasonably warm temperatures that we've had over sort of most of this week, and we trend back to that cooler air. So a nice high pressure system moving in over the weekend. You know, we'll start to see those showers easing and potentially even a bit of sunshine about the state on the weekend, but cold starts indeed. So especially through those inland parts, by the time we get to sort of Sunday morning, we could be seeing some inland frost, Tony.
Okay, so we could have some frost warnings early next week.
Yes, we could. I don't believe that we actually are doing frost warnings anymore. Maybe I'll have to brush up on that one too. But
really?
Yes, it certainly could be. I think it depends on the area and maybe the time of year, but I think people just get a bit sick of the rinse and repeat frost warnings every day in winter time.
Yeah, I suppose winter time you can expect the frost to be there, can't you?
Exactly, yeah.
Now, for those going boating, what have we got?
Look, today we're looking at those north and northwesterly winds around 20 to 30 knots, just starting to increase to sort of 20 to 30 knots as we move through sort of the afternoon and evening. And into tomorrow, we'll really see those stronger northwesterlies at 20 to 30 persisting through the day. And then shifting sort of southwesterly through the late afternoon and evening as we see that front come through. And when that happens, just potentially some of those winds about the north and west there picking up to around 35 knots. In terms of the swells through the west and south, we've got a west to southwesterly 1.5 to 2.5 metres. That's going to build through tomorrow to be about 3.5 metres by the evening. Through the north, a westerly below 1 metre for today and tomorrow, and through the east, a southerly around 1 metre for both today and tomorrow, where we currently have the Maria Island buoy sitting on that significant wave height of 1 metre, a max wave height of 1.6 and a peak period of 10 seconds, Tony.
And the warnings, did we do them? No.
No, we haven't done warnings yet. Look, we just have that minor flood warning out for the North Esk River, and that's associated with that rainfall that's coming through today. So expecting to see that possibly reaching the minor flood level at Thursday night, or tonight and into tomorrow morning. And we're also keeping an eye on the Meander and the Mersey rivers there. As well as that, we've obviously got our coastal wind warnings as well. A little bit of wind out there. So today, a strong wind warning for all of the coastals except for the southeast coast. And then as we move into tomorrow, we see the strong wind warning extend throughout all of the coastals and the southeast inshore waters, and increase to a gale wind warning for the far northwest and central west coast. Tony?
Now, just before you go, Ursula, I've got a text from C who says, "Hi, Tony, I still appreciate frost warnings." There you go. They appreciate them.
There you go. I think now that I'm racking my brain, I'm pretty sure in summer we do frost warnings.
But not in winter.
Because that would be unusual. But yeah, in winter we'd be issuing them every day, Tony.
Beauty,
tends
thanks.
To not be a warning anymore.
No, true. Thanks, Ursula.
Cheers, bye.
Cheers. Ursula Connor from the Bureau with the latest information on the weather for you. Eating rabbits. Do you eat rabbit? When was the last time you had rabbit stew or roast rabbit? Was it on the menu at your place? We'll talk about that in a moment.
Rick Goddard for breakfast.
Let's get to Trump Tower. We'll have it at Primrose Sands.
How many stories are you thinking?
Oh, 50, 60, Prim Vegas.
Mornings with Leon Compton.
The Fragrance Group, they proposed a building that I think was 140 stories.
Into it, I love it.
That was right down on the waterfront.
Elegant,
it
tall.
Would have,
for everything Hobart.
Yeah, elegant,
beautiful.
It would have dominated the Hobart skyline.
Let's put it at Primrose Sands, the Gold Coast of southern Tasmania.
Rick Goddard from 5:30 and Leon Compton from 8:30. Each weekday from 936 ABC Hobart. It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, recent good rainfalls has rabbit numbers booming across southeastern Australia, including Tasmania, with calls for more funding to control their populations. But the once cheap meat remains expensive to buy because of supply issues. Eliza Burlage has the story.
When you think of luxury foods, lobster and oysters tend to come to mind, not rabbit. Once sold door-to-door as affordable fare for working-class people, these days rabbit meat is more common in the fine dining scene. When South Australian chef Peter Kent plates up his rabbit ragout, he thinks about how the ingredient has evolved.
I've probably had rabbit on and off for the last couple of years. I run it and then take it off for a bit. When we put it on the menu, the demand for or the call for it is really overwhelming. Coming into winter is my favourite time for cooking. Anything slow cooked and, you know, at a local wine is fantastic.
For many families, dishes such as rabbit stew were once a staple. But after the release of biocontrol methods, such as the myxtosis virus in the 1950s, rabbit fleas, and later the Khaleesi virus in the 1990s, rabbit numbers dwindled and the price of the meat increased. Over the last two decades, Australia's rabbit farms have decreased from more than 550 to fewer than a dozen, mostly due to operational costs and disease control. Peter Kent says getting his hands on the meat can be a challenge.
Every now and then I do find it hard to source them. Probably around $15 a kilo. So it's not as cheap as kangaroo, for instance. So it does take a little bit more time if you want to take the meat off the bone. But if you're happy, you know, to stew the rabbit at home, leave it on the bone. Always cook on the bone anyway because it gives a sweeter flavour.
At his stall at Adelaide Central Market, butcher Tony O'Connell says his once-a-month delivery of wild-harvested rabbit meat is highly sought after.
If we can get 400 rabbits on a Friday afternoon, we'd sell them Saturday morning, not a problem. Unfortunately, our rabbit supplier is a part-time fisherman as well, and so he sort of goes out once a month, and we get as many as he can get, and obviously on that weekend we'd sell a lot. If we get excess, we will wrap them and freeze them, so we would have them for another week or so, but other than that, they go very quickly, especially in winter.
Mr. O'Connell says while demand is strong, scarce supply and higher operating costs for shooters has driven up the price.
A couple of guys going out shooting the weekend, truck, petrol, bullets, time out there. You know, it's 3 or 4 days out on the road at a time, sleeping in the back of trucks, and then coming back and processing them. And it's not a cheap meal, it's not a cheap exercise anymore, and it is hard work.
Tanya Barr is a chef whose business Straight to the Source connects restaurants with producers. She says wild harvested rabbits are also available and are about half the price of farmed rabbits.
They're both delicious and they both can be quite sweet and quite delicate in flavour.
Outside of Australia, rabbit is a delicacy in places like France and Malta. But Tonya Barr says the high cost and skills needed to catch and prepare it has led to a decline in wider use.
It has evolved over the last 25 years in terms of being more popular on menus and now not as much. I've seen them for $90 for sure. You know, that's kind of cost prohibitive for a lot of families when they can buy a chicken for $20 because of knowledge with disease and what have you. You need to know what you're doing.
Tonya Barr believes a resurgence in mobile abattoirs could make rabbit meat more easily available.
This will hopefully mean we will find more game at a better price point for everyone, including restaurateurs, food manufacturers and home cooks alike.
In the agricultural sector, rabbits are still considered pests, and experts say wild populations are at their highest rate since the 1990s. Jack Goff is a chief executive of the Invasive Species Council and says rabbits can have a profound impact on the environment. While he supports rabbit meat becoming a popular, sustainable food source, he says new biocontrol methods are what's key to reducing the population.
In the 1940s, Australians were consuming about 40 million rabbits a year and making no impact on the population. It wasn't until we got those biocontrols, the myxomatosis in the 50s, rabbit fleas, and then the Khaleesi virus in the 90s, that we started to see declines in rabbit populations. The unfortunate reality with rabbits is you need to remove about 87 out of every 100 rabbits just to see the population decline next year.
Back in the kitchen, Peter Kent hopes by seeing rabbit on the menu, more people will be encouraged to try and use the meat themselves.
We incorporate a lot of different flavours to it. You know, we add some red wine or shallots, garlic, thyme to really bring out a nice flavour. One of the reasons I do put it on the menu is, you know, trying to, I guess, get other people interested in eating a lot more of it. And if everyone gets a taste for the rabbit and then can cook their own, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah, Chef Peter Kent ending that story from Eliza Burlage about eating rabbit. You can read more about that story online at abc.net.au/rural. Tony on the text line says, curried rabbit, Tony, nothing better than when your old mum did it. Yeah, fantastic. And Lisa says, hi, Tony, wild rabbit is one of my staple foods. I'm having it for lunch. It's great for people who need lean meat. Thank you, Lisa. Do you eat rabbit? How do you cook it? 0438 922 936 is our text line number. Now, still to come on today's edition, soil and water issues with regard to El Nino and the Hereford cattle happy on a Central Highlands farm. First up, the news headlines with Michael Della Fontana.
Thank you, Tony. Vodafone says most customers' mobile phone services have been restored after a major outage this morning. Users across the country reported being left without 4G or 5G mobile access. The telco says it has since isolated and resolved the issue, blaming an outage at one of its network hubs. Australians are being urged not to ignore the free bowel cancer screening kit arriving in their letterbox, with new figures showing the program is saving lives. New data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare shows bowel cancer deaths have nearly halved since the national screening program began in 2006. Australian Institute of Health and Welfare spokesperson Moira Hewitt says getting in early improves people's chances of survival. And in the NBL, the Jack Jumpers' first Tasmanian-born recruit has described returning to play for his home state as surreal. Taran Armstrong grew up in Burnie and was the first Tasmanian basketballer recruited into the NBA. The 24-year-old was named in the Australian Boomers Asian Qualifiers squad earlier this month and will line up for his first Jack Jumpers game in September. More news at 1 o'clock.
Kylie Baxter for Drive.
Still got that feel on the roads. Outbound on the Brooker, slow past Risdon Road.
Evenings with Helen Shield.
Gav, what is on your shirt?
Apart from the scraps of me lunch, I've got a Greenspoon shirt on.
Hey! For everything Hobart.
There's one tonight.
Back, baby. Yeah. And it's because of all the Winnie the Pooh-ness last night. It's Quidstaffer Robin.
Quidstaffer. Okay. Kylie Baxter from 4 and Helen Shield from 6:30. 936 ABC Hobart.
On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour. with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, this week, the Bureau of Meteorology officially declared El Niño active with an extended period of warmer than normal waters in central tropical Pacific. The BOM says the cycle often brings drier conditions to central and eastern Australia in winter and spring, but outcomes can vary, shaped by other climate factors. But whatever the weather, wherever you are, and regardless of the type of farming, Stuart Andrews from the Natural Sequence Farming Movement is encouraging people to prepare the land to be more productive by adopting what he says can be learnt from nature.
Managing our water, holding on to it, getting it into the soil and growing more plants that feed the small water cycle, that's what we would do in preparation so that when we have these El Niño events, they don't affect us too much. You know, our landscape's resilient, our production system is resilient, and we can breeze through and we don't have to be so fearful of these events coming through. They've been coming through for a long time. So just setting our landscape up so that it can handle it when they arrive.
Does it allow you to prepare whatever the weather?
It does. The thing is, the same mechanism you use to prepare for a dry period is exactly the same mechanism you prepare for a wet period or for a fire event. You know, it's all the same. A lot of these things impact us a lot more these days because our landscape has lost the resilience to deal with these events. So, you know, if we understand that the landscape was able to do this before, ask the question, how did it do it? What do we need to do so that that functions again? And all of a sudden, these things are far less of an impact and, you know, we don't need to worry about them.
You've been putting your practices to the test right across Australia with the people who do your courses. What have you been changing on that land and what results have you seen from that?
Well, the main thing we're changing is the landscape to be ready for rainfall when it comes. So depending on where you are, I mean, we've travelled right around Australia. So some areas are heavy clay soils with low rainfall. And what we need to do is we need to get that particular landscape cracking, going through the cracking process. So when rain comes, the cracking process allows it to absorb into the landscape. So there, we're getting that going. Other areas, like closer on the coast, where you get big rain events fairly often, we need to be able to slow. So we build contours to slow the speed the water runs off so it soaks into the ground and grows the vegetation, which gives a great small water cycle and keeps the moisture around for longer through plants evaporating that into the landscape and then having it come back at night as dew. And whenever water is moving, it's carrying fertility. Because we're slowing down the speed of which the water moves, we're managing to hold that fertility in our landscape, which of course allows us to grow the higher order plants, which is a big thing for a farmer and a production system.
I saw this fascinating news that has come out of London where they've released beavers back into the wild around 400 years after they were hunted to extinction. And those beavers have stopped flooding of the tube stations and also resulted in the wetlands around it acting as a great big sponge.
Yeah, it's a buffer. I mean, we're doing the same work. Unfortunately, we don't have beavers in this country and we're probably not going to be allowed to have beavers. We don't have the right timber for them to start with. So that role falls upon us to be able to carry that out. But, I mean, that's just another process in nature that shows that what we're talking about is right. We just have to get with the program and follow what nature is giving us the indication to do.
And if you look at aerials of the farms where this work has been done and the land next door, what visual changes are you seeing?
Oh, well, the main thing is that the green for longer. Green over a greater area and for longer. That's probably the primary thing. A lot of what we see goes on below the ground. So, you know, the average person isn't seeing that. But when you start to see a landscape staying green longer than anybody else's, there's a huge production increase. So people see production increases anywhere from 20 to 50% very early on in the piece. That's a key, but maintaining green for longer is really, really important because that's what gives you the resilience, that's what keeps the small water cycle working, and that's one of the things that people see in, you know, the first 6 to 12 months after doing some work.
What about different production systems? I mean, you run pasture-raised chickens and pigs and beef on your property at Kaibong, south of Gympie, but can this be used in horticulture?
everywhere. It works all over the place. We've worked with macadamia farms down on the north coast of New South Wales. So the principles are the same all over. It doesn't matter what you're doing, cropping, horticulture, grazing, you can utilise the same information. Sometimes it requires a slight rethink on how the production system works. So if you're working in horticulture, generally you've got machines working up and down slopes. So you have to construct, if you're going to be building contours, you have to construct contours so they fit within that harvesting or maintenance method of those orchards. That's all possible. It just requires a little bit of thinking. And the responses, I know that in one macadamia property, the growth of the trees was exponential in that first 6 to 12 months. They really responded to that extra hydration working and the hydrology functioning better through that landscape. So, yeah, it can work anywhere.
And how much could it reduce the need for irrigation?
Oh, dramatically. Yeah, dramatically. I mean, it doesn't eliminate it completely because we're still going to go through dry periods. But what it does is that when you irrigate, it makes the irrigation far more effective. So a lot of water is lost through the profile of the soil because the soil underneath is dry, where if you're able to hold water and keep that lower soil wet for longer, then the water that you put on the top, you need less of it to be more effective.
Yes, Stuart Andrews from Tarwin Park Training speaking with Jen Nichols. He says there's plenty of free information on their website and on YouTube with their documentary Rehydrate Australia. The owners of a Hereford stud in the Central Highlands believe the breed's making somewhat of a comeback after the rise of the Angus breed around the country. And the multi-generational family are keeping the genetic line strong on farm after picking up a couple of new bulls at the recent National Hereford sale in Victoria. I dropped by the property to find out more from the father and son combination.
Philip Davey, I'm on the Guildford property up at Ouse. And this is my son, Jack.
G'day, Jack. How long have you been working here? All your life, obviously?
I've finished school 2022 and been here full-time since. Before then was just over weekend and school holidays.
Yeah. Phil, tell us about the property. How big is it?
It's about 6,000 acres in total. Yeah, we run Pole Hereford cattle, both a commercial herd and a stud herd, and also a flock of self-replacing prime sam sheep.
I tell you what, just looking at the animals, the sheep and the cattle, they look in really good condition. They look fabulous.
Yeah, they're not going too bad. We could always do with a bit more rain here. It's we're always looking for another rain.
What do you do for water here?
We've got creeks and water holes, and we do rely on about three or four bores.
Have you got enough feed? You grow a bit too?
We do try and make our own hay and silage, and hopefully we have enough. Sort of in this area, we have no irrigation, we never really know how much we'll cut each spring or if any.
Tell us about the trip to Wodonga to the bull sale.
All right, I went to the Wodonga National Hereford show and sale. Yeah, try and source a couple of new bulls for our stud. Yeah, had a fairly good trip, and I picked up a couple of bulls that I was very happy with. We got lot 9, Mawara Ace of Hearts, and we picked him up for 18,000. He's a really nice long bull, deep in the body and beautiful hindquarters, and I think he'll really complement our program well. The other bull I got was lot 90. He was Tarkham Knockout, and he's got the type of figures and type of bull that we're after as well. So we look forward to using both those bulls this year.
Now tell me the story, Philip. You had your eyes on the record bull, the $66,000 bull. Were you surprised he got that sort of money?
We had him on our list, and we had him a couple of good looks at him, but I was sort of had decided on lot 9, and then I thought I'd see how lot 73, the one that made 66, went, and he sort of took off in price before I got a chance to bid, so I waited for lot 90.
You didn't put your hand up for that?
No.
Tell us about the sheep on the property. What sort of sheep are they? What special type of sheep, aren't they? And they're lambing already.
Yeah, so they're already lambing at the moment. They're what they call Sams or South African meat merinos, more for like their meat.
Do they have any problems, the lambs, over the coming winter? Well, they'll grow big enough to cope.
Yeah, they should do, yeah.
And what do you do with the sheep? What's the plan there with you're talking about meat. Do you do any wool at all?
Yeah, we do a bit of shearing on them. Yeah, we'll soon sell them in October, November, before the end of the year.
Philip, now the cattle. What's the plan with the cattle? Has anything changed? I know we've got your dad watching here. He's been here all his life and probably set up a lot of the way you do the cattle and what happens to them. Tell us what's the business plan with the cattle?
Probably just keep going as we are, keep improving all the time, looking to breed cattle that, apart from the once you get the basics right, structure and fertility, we're pretty well. Emphasis on growth, getting them to grow fast. Obviously they need the ability to fatten easily as well, so we're always looking for bulls that are positive for fat. Good fast growing ones make heavy weaners.
Who's buying the cattle? You had your bull sale recently, didn't you?
Yes, we had our bull sale recently. The bulls pretty much go right across Tasmania, various people, King Island, Flinders Island, mainland Tasmania. We didn't sell any to the mainland this year, but we have, in the past we've sold some, and we've even sold two as far as Western Australia.
The Hereford breed, are they becoming more popular, do you think, in Tasmania?
You see a lot of Angus cattle up at Piranha Sales. A couple sales ago, people were saying that they reckon Herefords will start to get popular again.
How popular were they before Angus came along?
Oh, I think they were quite popular. I remember a lot more Pole Hereford studs, even in the south of the state. So obviously there was demand for more bulls. Yeah, I often talk about Angus selling better, but I would say, especially this year up at the Weiner sales, the Herefords have... the well-bred ones have been right up there and probably as good or better than the top Angus. So I think with our own calves we've been selling as weaners. We've actually been to four sales now, and I believe we've had the top price weaners at each sale. So,
and what's the big thing about them? What's attracted you to the Hereford breed?
Oh, well, that's what I grew up with, so I think they're just well-suited to our area, and, they
easy to manage?
Yeah, good temperament. They grow well, handle the tough times, and I can't see any advantage in going to Angus. I think we're much better off sticking with what we've got and improving on that.
All right, Phil, thanks for your time on the Country Hour. We appreciate it.
Yep,
thanks, mate.
Thank you.
Phil Davey and son Jack from the Guildford Hereford Stud at Ooze, where they also run some South Australian meat merino sheep. Well, livestock loss is taking on a new meaning for some pastoralists in outback South Australia as record-breaking rain leads to hidden sheep and isolated cattle. At Cowrie Station to the west of Lake Eyre, Sharon Oldfield has been dealing with side effects of rain for months now, including a new formed cow island.
So the roads have basically been closed since February, and we've had three large rain events. So each rain event has just put more water in Lake Howitt. And quite personally, I have never seen Lake Howitt as big as it is. It's about 60 kilometres around, about 20 kilometres across, and it's about 3 metres deep in the middle at the moment, which is enormous. It's huge. It's a huge lake. I didn't actually think it could get that big.
Major outback roads like the Birdsville and Strzelecki tracks remain closed, while smaller roads have begun opening for local use in some parts of outback SA. However, moving livestock is another question.
As far as transporting livestock, that's only just starting to happen in the last couple of weeks, through the use of this private detour at Myramitta, which is not a very good detour, but it's serviceable for trucks for the limited use of local use at the moment. And we are not able to transport many livestock out because all of our cattle are still stuck in our floodplain area. The river is still in full flood. So we're still certainly living with the impacts of the rainfall and the flood.
That livestock that's on the floodplains, can you get to them, or are they fully just isolated?
We can get to them by air, and we've been checking on them by air, and, I mean, they're all fine, just living the dream out there at the moment. But, yeah, no, we can't muster them at the moment at all. Stock losses were minimal, thankfully, so we'll just wait until we can actually get over there and have a look and muster them on the ground, because it is still a lot of water out on the floodplains, and the channel's still absolutely full. A lot of water to run into Lake Eyre through the Diamantina Warden system and the Georgina.
Miss Oldfield is not the only one having issues getting to her stock. In the state's far east, Kwandong Station is greener than it has been in a very long time, with water still covering large parts of the nearly 150,000 hectare station. Mary Lou Bishop says the station is home to thousands of sheep, even if they are playing hide and seek at the moment.
I have no idea how much livestock we've got out there at the moment. We probably saw 100 in one paddock, but that's it. We've got thousands out there that we don't know where they are or what they're doing, because they don't need to come into the troughs for water. There's water everywhere. Oh. Hopefully they're out there and that they're lambing.
Have you ever had that before where you just don't know where they are?
No, I'm getting drone people in with a thermal drone to come and have a look, see if they can find the sheep.
Enter Tony Eldridge and Colleen O'Callaghan. The couple run Tempt Security and Night Vision Solutions, a travelling security consultancy company that focuses on helping out larger stations.
We go out to the properties and we complete an assessment. We have a look with the drone and have a look at evidence of human activity, such as tracks, campfires, wood harvesting, you know, any signs of illegal hunting, stock theft reports, any fences that have been cut. Using our drone, we'll survey the landscape, but also work with the landholder.
The technology has come in handy following the heavy rain.
So as we're driving along, if we see washouts and things like that, particularly if we take the recent floods through South Australia and Western New South Wales, is being able to throw the drone up and fly it, you know, 5 to 8 kilometres down the road, assessing washouts, culverts, runoffs, flooded areas, having a look at fences, whether they're down, damaged, a stock on the road, a stock gone through fence lines into neighbouring paddocks, and things like that. So it's an absolute natural progression to use the technology we already have for multiple purposes, which is just amazing.
Yeah, Tony Eldridge from TEMT Security and Night Vision Solutions, ending that report from Isabella Kelly. And you can read more if you head to ABC Rural online. Well, a mega deal to sell water back to the government has been announced today on a federal government tender website. The deal involves a company associated with an Australian super fund selling water for the environment at a premium price. Warwick Long spoke to David Farley, One Nation's member for Farrer, who's not happy with the deal.
What's been reported today is a massive $360 million water buyback out of the heart of the food bowl of Australia. It's an enormous amount of water, circa 86 gigalitres of water. It will have an immediate impact on production. It'll have an immediate impact on spring planting and irrigation intentions. And ultimately, it's going to have a flow-on effect straight into the supermarkets of Australia.
Who's selling this water?
Well, this is interesting in its own right. It's State Street, which is part of Aware Super, which is the superannuation money of the New South Wales, Victorian and some Western Australian state employees.
So this is one company selling a huge amount of water back to the government here.
Correct. Now, this water was always available for production each year. The manager of that money, the Argyle Fund out of Brisbane, managed that water on behalf of the government, of the superannuation funds, and put it into production every year. Now, that all that water that's been sold today is out of the food production chain completely. So it's a massive, massive hit to the heartland, or to the heart of the food bowl of Australia, where 40% of Australia's food comes from.
So that's your issue here, is the fact that this water's being sold. And I've pulled up the government tender documents now, and it's even higher than what you've quoted. $430 million is the figure I've got here. Either way, it's a huge amount of water.
Huge amount of money.
And a huge amount of money, as you're right. But your problem is not that the fact that this one company is selling water, but they're selling water out of the irrigation system. Is that right?
Correct. It's, well, out of the food supply chain of Australia. So here's the other problem we've got. At the moment, the 2007 Water Act is under review. The 2026 review of the Murray-Darling Basin program is under review. The development of a food drought security strategy for Australia is being drafted at the moment. Why has the government stepped into the market and prematurely bought this water before they got clear visibility on the results of those three incredibly important reports and reviews?
Yeah, that's One Nation's David Farley speaking with Warwick Long there, talking about a mega deal to sell water back to the government. It's been announced today on a federal government tender website. The deal involves a company associated with an Australian super fund selling water for the environment at a premium price. And we'll be back with another Country Hour after midday tomorrow.